This is Fresh Air. American roots music is Ry Cooder's specialty. He's made around 10 albums featuring his versions of blues, jazz, gospel, depression ballads, Tex-Mex, and rock and roll. He's an accomplished guitarist who first built his reputation on his bottleneck technique. He even plays blues mandolin. He did a lot of guitar session work before making his own records. It was Cooder on slide guitar on the Rolling Stones record Love in Vain. Cooder has also composed many movie scores for such films as The Long Riders, Southern Comfort, Streets of Fire, and Paris, Texas. More recently, he was in the band Little Village with John Hiatt, Nick Lowe, and Jim Keltner. Cooder is currently working on a new soundtrack album and doing session work and music for commercials. Our interview was recorded last year. We're featuring it today as part of our weekly edition of Fresh Air Favorites from the Archives. Let's get started with something from Cooder's first album. This is Brownsville.
I'm going to Brownsville, take that right-hand road. Well, I'm going to Brownsville, take that right-hand road.
Over the years, you've learned and played so many different kinds of music, all forms of blues, Tex-Mex, Hawaiian music. I'm wondering if there's a music that you consider to be your roots.
Well, that's interesting. I've never thought about that, really. There's so much I've heard it for so many years, although maybe Johnny Cash. I mean, the first thing I ever heard that I really related to on the radio as a child was Johnny Cash. I mean, after hearing Beethoven and stuff, but I can't say that Beethoven's a root guy for me. But, I mean, before Woody Guthrie is there, and there's a kind of a funny area of music hardly made anymore by marginal white people, that I really loved as a kid, which was this kind of country blues thing, and it's also played by black people, of course, you know. But I mean, early on, before I ever heard blues players, I heard Woody and I heard Johnny Cash, and I used to think, these guys are really, wherever they are, and I had no idea where they were. You know, I lived in Santa Monica. As far as I knew, this was what life was. I had no idea, you know, that there was another world or culture or lifestyle out there. And, you know, I would have loved to have gone to these places, but the best thing I could do was turn on the radio at the time.
Do you think of yourself now as a, or have you thought of yourself over the years as a marginal white person?
Yeah, I sure do. I mean, I think that's the best place to be, is on the margin, out there on the periphery somewhere hanging on, because it allows you to do two things. You can see in. You have a kind of a luxury if you're on the edge looking in. You can see the whole picture if you've trained yourself, or if you're in the habit of looking that way. And music's a way of seeing, you know. It's a way of understanding people or situations or life or the world through the sound. If you listen in, you hear things other than notes, is all I'm saying. And the other good thing about being on the margin is you see out away from the middle. So you're sort of, you know, and you can drop off the planet a little once in a while and go see the Tex-Mex guys in McAllen, Texas, or the Hawaiian folks over there and on the beach somewhere, you know, because you're not committed or you're not locked into a one way or another of seeing and thinking, you know. So I tend to stay on the edge, the periphery there, as long as it's possible anyhow.
How were you exposed to blues when you were growing up?
Well, it was hard to be exposed to blues living in Santa Monica, you see. There wasn't anybody playing blues. And then you could listen to radio station KGFJ. Hunter Hancock would once in a while sneak in a Jimmy Reed record or something, like maybe Lowell Fulson or somebody. And so he said, well, that's different, that's interesting. And then along came the folk revival and the blues revival attached to it, like the baggage car, and or actually the coal car, the burner. And along came Chris Strachwitz, and he with our Hooley Records, and he found Lightning Hopkins for us and brought us, you know, he brought us in to see some people like that. And there was the Ash Grove, the nightclub in L.A. that featured some of these by then older guys who were still active. And as far as they were concerned, it was just another way of making some money, and another audience happened to be white. And of course, for me, it was tremendous just to get in a car and drive to Hollywood and see these guys like Mississippi John Hurt and Sleepy John Estes, just apparently from Mars or some planet, where people looked like this, talked like this, had strange clothes and shoes that turned up on the toes with the orange soles. I just could not imagine where these people were coming from, but you knew you wanted to go with them. It's Pied Piper-like thing, you know. I must have been about 12, 13 when all that started to happen.
Were you ever disappointed by how they sounded in person?
Oh, yeah. I wanted it to be just like the record. At first I did, anyhow. I thought, can't he play that lick I love so much? Then I learned, of course, that's not the way music works. That's not the way people work. See, it's an education there. And it was fun then to find that things could change and you didn't have to. In other words, it wasn't just a matter of recreating. If you wanted to experience this music, you weren't really supposed to recreate in yourself what had happened at that moment in time in, say, 1929 or 1940 or something. You were just supposed to just learn to surf across the wave of this thing, you know, just catch the groove. But nobody can tell you that. You have to kind of feel that for yourself, you know.
Early in your career, you did some session work with groups like Paul Revere and the Raiders, and they had the hits like Kicks and Good Thing, and Jackie DeShannon, who recorded What the World Needs Now, and you were on one of the Stones records doing some studio work. How did you get from, you know, the folk scene to studio work?
Yeah. Well, that was quite a leap, although it wasn't the leap it is now. I mean, I guess what happened was there was suddenly a moment when folk rock was viable commercially, you know. It, I guess thanks to Bob Dylan and then the Byrds. And this all hit in L.A. like a ton of bricks. I mean, it really went off. It set a lot of flares up, see, and suddenly everybody was into music and the Beatles and everything. And I went to Santa Monica High School. You know, music was considered just as ridiculous. It was absolutely de classe, outre thing to be interested in, even talk about, until the Beatles had their hit, and then everybody started letting their hair grow and talking about this stuff. I mean, it was like a social fact. It was like an atmosphere in your life that was never to go away. So I was, of course, very contemptuous. I thought, you know, these people just don't understand. We already knew that, you know, this stuff is already out there. So since I had no, I didn't relate to what was going on in school and things, and so I used to hang out with musicians who were older and hung out at these little folk clubs and stuff. And by, Taj Mahal appeared on the scene. He came out from Cambridge. And we would sit around and play, and we liked the same stuff. So he said, well, look, these guys, the Byrds, they're working. There's Bob Dylan's, he's working, you know, let's us work. And so we went to Ed Pearl, who ran the Ash Grove, and said, here we are, and give us a job. And he did, naturally. You know, didn't pay us anything, but said, open for somebody, you know, just do some songs. And then we did that, and then make a long, pretty long story, a little shorter, we went on and the record companies had awakened to the fact that they might have somebody out there. There might be something they could do and turn this sort of folk garage band thing into product, you know. And we got signed to Columbia Records, and we had this band, and it was terrible. But it was really no good for anything except that it got us in the door at the record company, which in those days that door was big and it was closed.
My guest is guitarist and singer Rye Cooter. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Rye Cooter is my guest. I think your best-known soundtrack is what you wrote for Paris, Texas. And you wrote this really kind of lonely, brooding kind of blues, but very, very kind of spacious, with lots of space between notes, lots of just notes resonating. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit how it certainly matches the mood of the movie? I mean, It's a pretty perfect fit. But maybe you could tell us a little bit how you came up with the sound for that film. Actually, before you tell us, why don't I play the most familiar part of that soundtrack? So maybe now you could tell us a little bit about, you know, creating that kind of mood musically.
Well, Wim called me up.
This is Wim Wenders, the director.
Wim Wenders, the director, called me from Berlin. He said he'd made a film. He wanted me to do the music. He'd see me in 3 days. So he came out to, and that was about all he said. He came out to Los Angeles, and he was in somebody's house, and he had this thing on video cassette, this film, Paris, Texas, which I knew nothing about, and went up there and took a look at it. With no music, just the empty, silent, kind of strange interior monologue that this thing is. And I thought, well, Lord, you know, this is great, and it's very beautiful, and what? Hopefully he'll know what he wants, you see, because it could go, you could do, people, you never know what directors are thinking, because you hope that they're thinking of something. But if they are, they better let you know, and it's important to pick up on the right thing so you don't go wasting everybody's time. So anyhow, he had found this Blind Willie Johnson piece. Actually, I had recorded it some years back, called "Dark as the Night," which is a kind of a modal study. It's just a bottleneck song that Blind Willie. It's the music of the spheres. I mean, it's some sort of root note thing. It's some sort of cosmic mood piece that the great Blind Willie Johnson had laid down for all time. And as far as Wim Wenders is concerned, this was the territory to be in. This was the place to go for this guy, because it was going to be the music of the man, the Harry Dean Stanton character, Travis. What it was like to be in his head, you know. Not to say that he goes around whistling this thing, but that he's coming from a place where things, if they had a musical identity, this is what it would be, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing outside in this film except empty space, the sky and the ground and the railroad tracks. So you have to say, well, we're operating in some other conscious area here, you know. So we can't be too linear, we can't be too lyrical. If you have a lot of counterpoint, a lot of rhythm, and a lot of musical ideas going on, it's just going to turn this little film over and sink it. See, it's going to be like you're going to rock the boat too hard in a very sensitive situation. So I figured he knew what he wanted, and I could hear this piece, and what I did was I kind of broke it down to some even simpler elements, maybe four-note element, and began to take that little theme, as it were, and try to develop it in a way that it could be heard or felt, hopefully not as somebody thinking real hard, and hopefully not as somebody reacting real hard and using all their brain. And what you want to do in a situation like this is turn your brain off. You know, people say, oh, you're not using your brain here. Well, you can't operate in this way if you're using your brain too hard, because you're just thinking and thinking and thinking. So you want to shut it off and get to the thing that you feel, you know.
I think it was Molson's who used your theme for their beer
yeah.
commercial.
That's right.
So they must have come to you and asked for permission to use it. You had to sell it to them, right?
Actually, what I did was I went and played it, and I played it again. And of course, now I don't do this as a rule, but you know, I thought, well, let's try it and see. It got to be where people were. They still do want to use this thematic little thing. This little it's almost a cliche now. You want to hear this guitar out there with the kind of drone underneath, and I've had to, you know. Had to receive the requests from cigarette companies and automobiles and cars and clothes, and they want to sell a lot of stuff with this, which is very odd, because you certainly never had that in mind. And it's, you know, it's not the most unpackaged sound I can make, and yet
right.
It's the one that the packagers like the best. Isn't that odd? Isn't that strange?
Are you glad that you did this for Molson's? Has it helped you a lot financially in a good way and given you more freedom? Where do you draw the line about when to and when not to use music for a commercial?
No, the Molson thing was a fee job. It was a very small fee. It was very small, and it's money I probably put into the yard. You know, got some a bigger lemon tree or something. And you know, you spend that money, and then you don't even remember what those.
I thought you would have made a fortune on that. They've used it so much.
No. I'm afraid not. I wouldn't mind making some real good money on an easy job. Although the more I try to do that stuff, the harder. You know, you can't go and do it for other reasons. It doesn't quite work. The truth of the matter is that. The real rich advertising money comes from something I don't know what. It certainly wasn't Molson's. I guarantee you that.
Guitarist and singer Rye Cooter, as recorded in May of last year. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air.